Welcome to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. We speak with writers, thinkers, and newsmakers on the controversial issues of human life and human thriving that impact our daily lives. We are exceptional as creatures in the cosmos, as equal members of the human family, and as ethical beings. Humanize explores some of the fundamental questions. How do we thrive? How do we live well and care for what we've inherited? How do we act responsibly with one another and in the wider world? And how do we conserve the good things of this life for the future? We matter. Our actions matter. Let's get into it. I'm Wesley J. Smith, and this is Humanize. Chimpanzees, we are told, are the closest relatives to human beings. Indeed, for years, scientists claimed that there is only about a 1% difference separating the human genome from that of chimps. Some advocates even claimed that means humans are mostly chimps, or that chimps are mostly human, eroding the principle of human exceptionalism. But research published last year disclosed that the 1% difference was badly off the mark, and that the true genetic difference is about 15%. But what does the difference statistic mean scientifically, and whether 1% or 15, does it matter morally? I invited one of the Discovery Institute's premier scholars to discuss the new findings and the meaning of it all. Dr. Casey Luskin is a scientist and attorney with a PhD in geology from the University of Johannesburg and a law degree from the University of San Diego. He also holds BS and MS degrees in earth sciences from the University of California, San Diego, and is a California licensed attorney. He works at Discovery Institute as Associate Director and Research Director of the Center for Science and Culture, where he directs the ID 3.0 research program and assists and defends scientists, educators, and students who seek to freely study, research, and teach about the scientific debate over Darwinian evolution and intelligent design. He has co-written, co-edited, and contributed to many books on ID, is a public speaker, and also a media commentator. Casey, welcome to Humanize.
Great to be with you, Wesley.
You have a law degree, which is I do too, but also a PhD in geology. But your work involves the issue of intelligent design, which concerns biological issues. What is ID, and why are you focusing your career on that issue as opposed to rocks and geodes?
Great question, Wesley, and one that I ask myself all the time. So intelligent design is a scientific theory which says that many aspects of life in the universe are best explained by an intelligent cause because they have the kind of information and complexity which in our experience only comes from intelligence. And so just to give you like a very, very basic sketch of what that means scientifically, look at what we have discovered is at the heart of life. In our DNA is a language-based code. We have these A, T, C's, and G's that are arranged in a very particular order in our DNA molecules in order to encode proteins. That information in our DNA then undergoes computer-like information processing to produce in our cells literal molecular machines. But in all of our experience, when we know the source of language-based code, or we see computer-like information processing, or we see machine-like structures being produced, in all of our experience, those kinds of natural features always trace back to a mind or an intelligent agent. So we would argue that what we see in living organisms is very neatly explained by appealing to an intelligent cause. Now, why do I do this instead of, originally I was going to do environmental law. That was actually my original plan. I was going to become sort of an environmental law do-gooder. I know you've probably swum in those spaces, Wesley, as well. And I had an undergraduate and master's degree in earth sciences from UC San Diego. My plan was to go to law school and get involved in that field. But simultaneously, I realized that there was this fascinating debate happening in the scientific community over our question of origins. Where did we come from? Are we the result of strictly unguided, purposeless material mechanisms, or is there actually an intelligent agent that intended humanity to be here on this planet for a purpose? And just to be honest with you, I found that question to be far more interesting than, you know, studying torts and property law in law school. Now, I still went through law school. I got the law degree. But that question, can we scientifically address how humanity originated, how life originated, how the universe originated, and actually find scientific evidence that there is an intelligent agent behind life in the universe? That argument, that question just captured my imagination. And so even during law school, you know, I would study all day so I could go and read intelligent design books and do intelligent design activities on the side. So I got to know a lot of the folks in the ID community. I'll spare you a lot of the details. But when I graduated from law school, I was offered a position at Discovery Institute to basically advise teachers on how to teach this question of origins objectively in the classroom without getting into legal trouble. So,
well, that brings up a question. The people who oppose intelligent design claim it's religion, and the intelligent design proponents say no, it's a scientific hypothesis. Which?
Well, you're certainly asking somebody with a strong opinion, but I'd like to think my opinion can be justified. I would argue that intelligent design is a scientific theory, and the reason why I would say that is because we can use our observation-based experience to make a case for intelligent design. Here's what I mean. In our experience, when we see language-based code, as I said earlier, computer-like information processing, machine-like structures, when we see those things being originated in our everyday experience, they always come from an intelligent agent. So then how do we respond when we see those exact same kinds of features underlying the basic heart of life in the natural world? This is an observation-based, empirically-based argument. I'm not invoking God. I'm not invoking religion or the Bible to make the case for intelligent design at the heart of life. I'm saying that what we see at the heart of life is based upon our observations, that we understand that information and language and machine-like structures only come from an intelligent agent. And so I'm making an argument based upon science, not based upon religion or faith or divine revelation. So that's how I respond to that. ID basically uses the scientific method to make its claims. It's not using religious methods, so to speak.
So you're not quoting Genesis to prove that ID is real?
No, I mean, I haven't in this argument just now. You know, I've said, look, where in our experience does information come from? We see information all throughout life in our DNA. Information in our experience always comes from intelligence. So that's what I'm quoting the book of nature. I'm not quoting any scripture here.
And how does ID differ from creationism?
Also a very good question, an important one that comes up a lot. Creationism is typically seen as the view that, you know, if you try to fit science with the Bible, and then you believe that the earth is 6 to 10,000 years old through sort of a literal interpretation of Genesis. Intelligent design does not try to address those kinds of questions, like how do we interpret Genesis or how do we fit science and the Bible together? Those are certainly interesting questions for people of faith, of which I am one. But ID is not focused on those questions. ID is focused on the question of, is there empirical evidence in the world around us that an intelligent agent was at work in producing these things? So it's a very different approach. You know, ID also doesn't take that sort of young earth creationist view, which says that the earth is only 6 to 10,000 years old. Most folks in the ID community would accept an old earth. I certainly am one of them. There are young earthers in our community who, you know, agree with the evidence for design of life, but ID is not arguing for a young earth. And that's why most of the leading ID folks, such as myself, would accept a billions of year old age for the earth and the universe. So ID is just not doing what creationism is doing, trying to synthesize science and the Bible, or, you know, going that down that young earth path. ID is asking the question, is there empirical evidence that modern science has discovered that shows us an intelligent cause is the best explanation for what we see?
And are there now ID peer-reviewed articles and studies published in scientific journals?
Yes, there are. I'm so glad you asked. This is a big part of my job, actually. You know, as I said, I started off doing law at Discovery, but over time they realized I had a science background. I left for about 5 years from 2016 to 2020, got my PhD in geology, actually. And when I came back in around 2020, 2021, I'm basically now the research director at Discovery Institute. And what we have a very active research program funding scientists all over the world who are looking at scientific evidence for intelligent design, looking at the complexity of these molecular machines, looking at the information that we have in proteins, looking at the fine tuning of the laws of nature to allow for life to exist. And yes, they are publishing peer-reviewed scientific papers. I just had to give a little presentation yesterday, and I checked my spreadsheet where I keep track of ID peer-reviewed scientific papers. We're now up to, I think it was 332 as of yesterday. Although Jim Tour, who's a professor at Rice University, whose research we support, he just emailed me a couple days ago, and we have another one from Jim that I need to process. Maybe it's 333, but it's very exciting to see a very vibrant research program growing out of the intelligent design community. And this is what I get to do in my day job these days, is manage that. It's a lot of fun.
All right, let's get to the issue at hand, which has to do with chimpanzees and human beings and genes and so forth. Humans are often called apes by those who reject human exceptionalism. What do you think? Are we apes?
Well, I mean, scientifically, some people would consider us apes. And, you know, this just gets into a question of semantics. The question of classification biology is famous for being highly subjective. So does this frog belong in this genus or that genus? Is this tree more closely related to ash or to magnolia? Scientists will debate these classification issues endlessly. So at the end of the day, there is a lot of subjectivity there. I would argue that no, we are not apes. I mean, certainly there are some similarities between humans and apes. But at the end of the day, the way I like to put it is that human beings are writing scientific papers studying apes, not the other way around. Okay. So there is certainly a huge gulf of intellectual capabilities between human beings and the great apes. And so to call us an ape, I think is really, I mean, it's kind of a joke, frankly, when you consider the great differences in the way we live our lives compared to them.
Yeah, when I hear of and read advocates saying, I'm an ape, I always say, speak for yourself. But we are primates, right, in terms of just a biological category.
Sure, no question we're primates. And human beings, we don't have a tail. We walk bipedally. The great apes, by the way, don't walk upright bipedally. They tend to knuckle walk and spend a lot of time in trees. We don't do that, obviously. Some of us like to climb trees occasionally, but we don't spend our life living in trees. So behaviorally, physiologically, and intellectually, we're very, very different from apes.
I remember back around 2008, big news hit that humans and chimps shared about 98% of our genetic makeup. But that study actually didn't measure all of our genes because it only measured the 2% of our genes that code for proteins. So that other 98% was actually 98% of 2%, wasn't it?
Yeah, you can kind of do some shady things with statistics when you're having these conversations. Even the Smithsonian Institution, if you go to their human origins exhibit, they say there is only about a 1.2% genetic difference between modern humans and chimpanzees throughout much of their genetic code. What is that much? You know, if you look at the part that isn't 1.2% different, then is that different? Does that different percentage go up? I think it does. So there have been a lot of statistical games that have been played with these numbers, and you got to always be clear on what exactly we're talking about.
And even at the time, 2% was more than met the eye. A 2005 study in Science reported that even though there was 2% difference, quote, in the genetic makeup, that actually amounted to 40 million identifiable basic biological distinctions between humans and chimps.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know exactly what you're thinking of, but there was an article in the journal Science in the year 2007. This was very soon after the chimp genome was first, the first draft of the chimp genome was produced. And yeah, they identified 35 million individual base pair differences between humans and chimps, plus 5 million indels. That's basically where you have a difference that is more than two or more base pairs that are different between humans and chimps, plus 689 extra genes in humans. So that's right. Even if we have only a couple percent difference between humans and chimps, that still yields tens of millions of differences at the base pair level when you compare our DNA.
Yeah, I think we're talking about the same study. I probably had the year wrong, but that's not infinitesimal. Tens of millions of differences is a profound amount.
Absolutely. We like to say that, you know, it's the differences that make the difference. Okay. So let's talk about, you know, how do differences work? Let's think about a football team. Okay. If you have a football team and you change the quarterback, that's going to have a huge impact on how that team plays. We're just approaching the Super Bowl as we record this. So it's a good time to talk about Super Bowl, talk about football. Seahawks are going this year. Hopefully they win. So, you know, there are some people on a team. You're from San Francisco, so you probably don't have to edit that out, Wesley.
I don't care about football. I'm a genetic freak.
Okay, fair enough. So, but the reality is that some differences can make a huge difference compared to others. So you change the quarterback on a football team is going to have a very, very dramatic impact on how the team plays. Now, you go into the fans in the stand and you swap out, you know, take 5,000 out of the 80,000 fans in the stand. Maybe you get rid of 1,000 of those fans and you swap out the other 4,000, it's probably not going to have a huge impact on how the team plays. Those fans might matter for something, But, you know, the point of all this is that different parts of our DNA function differently. So sometimes you can change a nucleotide in the DNA. If it's, say, encoding the active side of a protein, that can have a huge impact. That single mutation can have a huge impact on how that organism lives, whether that mutation is actually perhaps going to cause a genetic disease or death. But you can change other parts of DNA. And yes, it might be functional in the same way that the fans in the stand play a role, but it's not going to necessarily kill the organism if you swap it out. So yeah, a 10 million base pair differences, if you're talking about very specific nucleotides that are changing in an organism, could make a huge impact on the way that organism lives, what its body plan is, how its proteins operate, you know, what climate it wants to live in. Does it live in trees or does it walk on the ground? Is it building rocket ships or is it, you know, eating dirt? Those 10 million base pairs, if you change the right ones, could have a huge impact on what an organism is.
And remember, we're, for the audience, we're still only talking about the potential 2% that was earlier thought to be true, not the latest study, which we're going to get into, which shows about a 15% difference, which you can't even imagine probably the numbers of millions and billions of differences that 15% would create. But getting back to the 2%, at the time, I remember a lot of advocates who were trying to tear down human exceptionalism, and I want to get into why people might want to do that. But they were saying, well, this means that we're mostly chimp, or some would say this means that chimps are mostly human. Would that be true?
Well, if you just talk about, you know, percent similarity of DNA, I suppose you could make that argument. But again, even a 1%, 2% difference means tens of millions of base pair differences, and those could lead to huge, what we call in biology, phenotypic differences between the two organisms. So I don't think you can make that argument that we're basically chimp or basically ape. You know, there's a book that came out a couple years ago called 99% Ape. And they're basically trying to make the same argument that you're making right now. This book, by the way, was authored by 7 university professors, published by University of Chicago Press. And it said, of the roughly 3 billion letters of the genetic code, the difference is just 1.06%. Meaning the difference is, quote, 1% of 3 billion of our genetic letters, okay? So even back then, this was known to be false, all right? So it's just astounding the amount of misinformation that's been put out to the public to try to make this argument that we are really no different from apes, from chimpanzees.
Why do you think people have that kind of apparently emotional investment in that argument?
Well, I think that it probably, I mean, we're getting into the psychology here. I think for a lot of folks, it really does get into a desire to diminish the specialness of humans. We've seen that talked about many times in the scientific literature that, you know, this or that line of evidence shows that we're really not as special as we like to think we are. So there's this trend in evolutionary biology that wants to see human beings as just another animal roaming the forest. There's nothing special about us. And if human beings were to, you know, be rid from the planet might even be better off. So I think that there's probably some ideology behind all this. Obviously, I can't speak for everybody, but I've certainly seen enough folks over the years making those kinds of arguments to know where it's usually coming from.
Of course, if humans disappeared from the planet and the planet became absolutely gorgeous and awesome, who would know? Because we're the only species that actually registers that kind of thinking and that kind of emotion. We're the ones who look at the sunrise and see beauty. It's not something that animals would tend to do. At least there's certainly no indication that they do. But moving on, subsequent research, we're now, you know, that was back 20 years ago. Subsequent research has found that the 2% or 1.2% or whatever it was is actually way understated. Why don't you tell us what happened?
Yeah, so let's start back to that 2007 article in the journal Science that noted that we have, as you said, you know, 35, 40 million base pair differences between humans and chimps. When they made those statements in 2007, that was based upon one of the earliest drafts of the chimp genome that was first published in 2005. Now, it turns out, and I didn't actually believe this until I went and kind of like did some research, it turns out that some of those early drafts of the chimp genome were actually built using the human genome as a scaffolding, which made these early drafts of the chimp genome appear more similar to humans than they truly should have been.
Let me interrupt you. Who was building the chimp genome?
Well, there were teams of researchers who were sequencing the chimp genome and trying to, you know,
And they inserted human genes into that model?
No, what they did was they used the human genome as a scaffolding. So they would sequence large sections of the chimp genome, but they wouldn't know where they would go. Okay.
So they put him where the humans were?
They use the human genome as a guide or a scaffold. Let me give you an exact quote from the NCBI website. Contigs are basically large sections of a genome when you sequence them. It says, contigs were assembled using the human genome as a guide and are therefore, quote, humanized in their construction. This is an important distinction, as some sequences, such as insertions, deletions, and gene duplications, may not be accurately represented by the current chimpanzee assembly. Okay. This is coming from the NIH's website that the chimp genome, the early drafts at least, not the current one, but the early drafts were humanized. They were stealing the name of your podcast, Wesley. they humanized the chimp genome because they used the human genome as a guide when they assembled these large sequences that they had, you know, sequenced. Okay. So I didn't believe this. I actually know a guy in the ID creationist community who worked on the sequencing of the chimp genome when he was doing a postdoc. And when he told me this, I was like, you got to be kidding me. But then I read it right there on the NIH website. So this procedure they used, this method they used, caused the earlier drafts of the chimp genome to look more human-like than they really were. So I would think it was probably in the late 2010s. That they finally produced.
Follow the science, Casey. Follow the science.
Yeah, absolutely. This is settled science. We're not allowed to question it. In the late 2010s, scientists finally produced a version of the chimp genome from scratch, or as they would call it, de novo, okay? Where they were not using the human genome as a scaffolding or a guide. However, they still had not sequenced the full chimp genome, what they call from one end to another, or is it sometimes called from telomere to telomere. Telomeres are these sequences of DNA at the very ends of chromosomes. So what they wanted to produce was a full, complete draft of the chimp genome, telomere to telomere, that was sequenced from scratch or de novo without using any human genome as a guide. And they finally published that last year in an article that was published in the journal Nature by Yu et al. Titled Complete Sequencing of Ape Genomes. And this is really the first time that they were able to give us a complete non-humanized version of these ape genomes, and we could finally do a comparison between humans and chimps and other apes. And what they basically found is that, no, we're not 1% or 2% genetically similar to or genetically different from chimps. It's more like 15% genetic difference between humans and chimps. And you can also, in the study's results, compare humans to orangutans and gorillas. With orangutan, we're between 19 to about 20% genetically different. And with gorilla, we're between 19.8 and 29.3% genetically different. We are far more genetically different than these ape species than anybody ever believed or even suspected, according to this study that came out in the journal Nature last year.
So I want to make it really clear here, because you've been criticized because you're not a geneticist for talking about this issue. This is not a finding you discovered. You didn't do the research. This is a finding that geneticists discovered, and it turned over, which is what science is supposed to do, previously thought truths about the connection between humans and chimps.
That's exactly right. I mean, as I said, this came from a paper by Yu et al. That was published in April of last year in the journal Nature. I was just trying to get this message out there. One of the things that kind of disturbed me a little bit was that Yu et al., although they did report these genetic comparisons between humans and these ape species, they buried it deep in the supplemental data, made it very, very difficult for people to find in these charts and these, you know, these tables that were very, very difficult to interpret. I had to consult with a geneticist and other biologists to make sure I was getting it right. And they confirmed that, yeah, Casey, your numbers are correct. Go ahead and talk about this. So I did a lot of background research, talking to biologists, even emailed the authors of the paper, you know, to confirm that I wasn't completely off, and reported
these numbers.
They did. They tried to kind of use that statistical game. Well, most of the genome is still very similar. And well, okay, that's true. But what about the parts that are not similar? You know, we got to tell the whole story here. For some reason, nobody wanted to tell the whole story. So when I did that, yeah, I did get beat up. I don't know if you ever heard of that old saying. It actually comes from this philosopher, Arthur Schopenhauer, the three stages of truth, that first they ignore you, then they mock you, ridicule, laugh at you, and then they say you've been right all along. I have never seen an issue go through Schopenhauer's three stages of truth so quickly, Wesley, because yes, at first they ignored me, and then they attacked me viciously. I mean, I just got piled on the internet. It was just absurd. I don't think I've ever been attacked this much. And then finally, this was starting in like May of last year. By September of last year, there was an article in Live Science, which is a very mainstream science journalism website, that acknowledged that we are in fact 15% genetically different from chimps. And I was right all along. Okay.
So, yeah, but you can't be right. They can be right, but you can't be right.
They can be right, but I can't be right. Yeah. It's not allowed. But I was just gratified to see the truth being acknowledged. You know, I can, I'm used to being attacked unfairly. I'm used to, you know, having people try to suppress the intelligent design view through personal attacks. We've been dealing with that for years. We sometimes like to say, Wesley, that we're being canceled before cancellation was even a thing. I mean, that really is the truth.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm okay with it. I just want the truth to come out, and I'm glad that it did.
I think it's also interesting how the media reacted. When it was 1%, those were big stories. And I ended up writing about that issue back in 08 and whatever the years were, because I went in preparing for this interview. I looked up what I wrote because I remember writing stuff. And it was and I was refuting some of what the media was saying, that, you know, we're this means we're chimp and so forth. But when it was 15%, which means, hey, they're not that close at all, crickets.
I mean, it's very hard for these arguments that they've made to die. Jonathan Wells, who was our colleague at Discovery Institute, he passed away about a year and a half ago. He used to call them the icons of evolution. Arguments that people use for evolution that turn out to not be based upon facts. They were actually based upon fiction. And I think that this 1% statistic, that we're 1% genetically different from chimps, it's like one of these icons. And Jonathan Wells wrote a book in 2017 called Zombie Science, where he basically said that the thing about these icons of evolution is they never die. People actually will never give up on them. Even when they've been refuted to death by the evidence, people will still make them. So it's very hard for people to give up these arguments. And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to make sure that the evidence got out there, Wesley. We've all heard this argument that we are only 1 or 2% genetically similar to chimps, and therefore, you know, you're just a slightly modified ape or whatever. I mean, listen to this from Bill Nye, the science guy. This is in his book, Undeniable. He said, we share around 98.8% of our gene sequence with chimpanzees. This is striking evidence for chimps and chumps to have a common ancestor. Okay. So he's using this as an argument for evolution. So, I just want people to be able to have the facts. You know, obviously we're not 98.8% genetically similar to chimps. It's more like 84.9, 85% similar. It's much less than that. How this cashes out for evolution, I don't actually know. I've never made the argument that a 15% genetic difference between humans and chimps somehow refutes evolution or refutes common ancestry. I don't believe that's true. I don't really think that the percent genetic similarity really tells us anything about, you know, these evolutionary questions. I think that, you know, it's kind of an open thing. Whether we were intelligently designed or we evolved from a common ancestor with chimps, none of those are going to give you a specific prediction about the exact genetic similarity that we're going to have with chimps. I just want the facts to be out there. And if people are using this argument and they're using bad facts, then that needs to be corrected. That's basically where I've been coming from.
Well, that's the purpose of science. I mean, science, properly understood, is looking for what's true. And it shouldn't be based on what we want to be true, but what is true. And of course, you would like ID to be true, but I'm assuming, and correct me if I'm wrong, you do not twist your scientific interpretations to that. And I think you just showed that by saying this doesn't impact whether we evolved or this statistic of 85%.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if we had turned out to be 99% genetically similar to a chimpanzee, frankly, Wesley, that would not bother me from an intelligent design perspective, because we know that designers will often reuse parts in different systems. We see that wheels are used on cars and airplanes, or keyboards are used on tablets and cell phones. I've done a lot of computer programming in my time, and we know that computer programmers, the first thing they do, you know, when they write a new program is they borrow or steal code from other sources. Okay. So it's very, very common practice for programmers to reuse coding modules in different systems. So maybe the fact that we share these similarities with other species reflects common design rather than common descent. I know you don't want to get into the weeds on this too much, but I would just say that, you know, whatever the percent genetic similarity between us and other species turns out to be, it's never bothered me. It is what it is. We'll deal with the facts and we'll go from there and try to get the best interpretation that we can.
Yeah. And in terms of my work, I've always said it doesn't impact human exceptionalism in the least, because the things that make us exceptional are what make us exceptional. And those are moral distinctions, not biological distinctions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think I agree with you 100%.
Your colleague, Ann Geiger, actually put it this way. She said, you know, different buildings were used the same kinds of building materials, bricks and lumber and so forth, but you could end up with completely different purposes for the buildings that are erected. So I think that was quite a good everyday metaphor that she proposed there.
Yeah, very much so. It's not just the parts that you've got, but how you're using those parts. And by the way, that's where a lot of these genetic differences come into play. Even the paper that was published in Nature acknowledged that a lot of these genetic differences control brain development. Okay, so we know that a lot of these genetic differences are changing the way that genes are expressed in our brains. We might have the same proteins, more or less, but the way those proteins are being used in human and chimp brains are very, very different, different numbers of proteins.
So it came to my attention that, you're always perusing to make sure that science is accurately stated about various issues, particularly this one, that you found out that the Smithsonian Institute, despite the study you've just described, despite the Science Live or whatever the journal was that said, no, we are 15% different, the Smithsonian had a display still saying 1.2%. Is that right? And what did you do?
That's exactly right, Wesley. When you walk into the Human Origins exhibit at the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C., in big letters on the wall, it says, you and chimpanzees, 98.8% genetically similar. Okay, so they are making sure that you don't miss this. And then if you go down further, it says that you and gorillas, 98.4% genetically similar. You and orangutans, 96.9% genetically similar. And it goes on to say, as you know, we gave sort of that fuzzy quote where it says there's only about a 1.2% genetic difference between modern humans and chimpanzees throughout much of their genetic code, whatever that means. All right. So the message that they want you to take at the Human Origins exhibit at the Smithsonian Museum in DC is that human beings and apes, and chimps in particular, are virtually identical in their DNA, just a minuscule percent difference.
Into the fact that even at that point, there were tens of millions of actual biological distinctions that we described earlier. They don't get into that, right?
They don't note that even, you know, a 1 to 2 or 3% difference yields tens of millions of base pair differences at the DNA level. No, they don't talk about any of that. They just leave it at these very vague numbers. So I wrote them a letter last year. I think it was in May or June, and basically said, look, this new paper in Nature, it shows that what you guys are showing at your exhibit is now outdated science. You guys need to update this. And they gave me kind of a non-response where they said, well, you know, every so often we update our exhibit. And whenever we do that, we take the latest science into account. So certainly we'll take this into account whenever we update the exhibit. So, you know, I hope they do. I hope that they will take this paper into account. And I also hope that they will update it sooner rather than later. Because right now, as far as I'm aware, as we speak, at this very moment, there are people in the Human Origins exhibit in Washington, D.C., who are receiving misinformation about the genetic similarity between humans and chimps. So this is not a good thing. Our taxes are paying for this misinformation.
No, and it wouldn't take them much to say the latest science, you could put up a sign, says it's 15%. Stay tuned for further developments in this hall.
Exactly. Would it be that hard to do that?
Yeah.
I'll go there with a paintbrush myself and, you know, put the right numbers in there. I don't think they want me to do that.
You know, and it's interesting because that actually, you know, is a really good indicator of how science is supposed to work. That no science is, quote, settled forever, and that when new information comes out, then the science understanding changes. This is a classic example of the scientific method working in the way it is supposed to work to bring forth greater and greater knowledge. But the, quote, science supporters are impeding that information from getting out to the public. It's really quite an irony.
That's exactly right. I mean, or they're trying to qualify it. If they do talk about it, they will say, well, look, if we look at humans, sometimes we might have, you know, 5 to 10% genetic difference within the human species, between two human beings. And that's very interesting. What does that mean? I think we're still trying to figure that out. But they'll try to say, well, look, maybe 15% genetic difference isn't that big a deal. This is actually when Live Science admitted that we were 15% different last year, they immediately qualified it saying, well, but human beings could be up to 5 to 10% different from each other. So maybe a 15% genetic difference isn't that big a deal. Well, it all depends on what that DNA is doing. As we talked about earlier, some sections of DNA can have huge phenotypic effects on the organism. Other sections of DNA, they might not be quote unquote junk DNA, but they still perform a role. And we don't know what a lot of this DNA is doing. We know that it's important, however. So there's still a lot of research to be done, a lot of, I think, new studies that are going to have to be done on the DNA that's different between humans and chimps, the DNA that's different within the human species to understand what all this means. But the bottom line is that, yeah, I think a lot of folks have invested a lot of rhetorical capital in this argument that we're only 1-2% genetically different from chimps. So losing that, they're not going to let that go easily.
Pretty clearly. You know, one can't think about chimpanzees without referencing the late Jane Goodall. I think she made some really excellent scientific observations, obviously, but she was also what I call a novelist, because writing in science papers, she gave the chimps an inner life that she could not possibly know they had. And that anthropomorphized the entire enterprise of looking at chimps and a lot of science that has to do with animals and biology. I think she did a tremendous disservice to science. I know I'm in a minority that she's this revered figure. But when you say in a science paper that the chimp sat around in the clearing and thought X, Y, and Z, then you're really not doing science anymore.
I don't know how she can read the minds of chimpanzees. I do know that a lot of the objective evidence, like, say, you know, tool use in chimps. Well, guess what? We now know that cows can use tools. We know that birds can use tools. Tool use is not just restricted to the primates. And so, I mean, I think that a lot of the evidence that they would use to say that chimps had, you know, human, near human-like intelligence. Well, what about other species? Other species that are very far removed can also show high intelligence. So that, you know, right there doesn't necessarily tell you that we're just a slightly modified chimpanzees. Maybe a lot of intelligence has been spread throughout the animal kingdom, and that's a good thing. That's what animals need to survive. That doesn't mean that they're on the verge of, you know, building skyscrapers and creating, you know, the next rock or something like that. I think that there's still this huge gulf between humans and chimps that evolutionary biologists and scientists have yet to account for.
Yeah, and she admitted that she did that on purpose, and it was intended to create an emotional response in the reader, which it did. And that's how she became world famous and very celebrated and all of that. I still, in the minority, think that, but it was harmful to science, because science isn't supposed to be about emotion. Science is supposed to be rational about empirical data, not interpreting things from an emotional or humanized perspective.
Yeah, and you know, the fact that maybe she could form emotional bonds with these chimps, okay, that's wonderful. That's a beautiful thing. I have a very close emotional bond with my cat, okay? I mean, he knows my patterns. He can predict what I'm going to do. He knows that I'm going to take him in the car and he goes and hides in the under the bed, you know? He understands. I think that animals and human beings are made to be able to interact and form bonds with each other, whether we're talking about chimpanzees or the cows on your farm or your pet dog or cat. It happens very, very naturally. It's the way that biology and the biosphere is set up for animals to form bonds with each other. So it's a beautiful thing, but it doesn't necessarily mean that therefore these chimpanzees are, you know, just a couple notches down from becoming like humans, or that, you know, that they have the same exact whatever value, worth, that a human being does.
Of course, the idea here is that because now we know it's 15%, but a quote, close quote, genetic affinity between our species and chimps, that means we came from a common ancestor. And there's this discussion of, well, we have to find the missing link that that connects, would have a common ancestor, would be the missing link, right? Have they found the missing link?
Okay, well, so first of all, when we talk about the missing link, this is one of those little gotcha things that folks in the evolution community will say is, well, we don't use the term missing link. Well, really, I can tell you, Wesley, that just about a month ago, the New York Times ran a headline that said that a new missing link was found in the hominid fossil record, okay? So yes, they do sometimes use the word missing link. But if you consider the missing link to be, I guess, a species that shows that humans evolved from an ape-like common ancestor or an ape-like ancestor, then I would argue that no, they have not found those quote-unquote transitional fossils that show humans evolving from the ape-like, say like the ape-like Australopithecines. When you look at the technical literature, it's actually widely recognized that there is a distinct break in the fossil record between the genus Homo and the human-like members of the genus Homo and, say, species like the Australopithecines, which were very ape-like and are supposed to be our direct ancestors. So I would argue that there is a major problem for the evolutionary story. When you look at the fossil record, there is a distinct break or gap right where they claim there's supposed to be evidence of these evolutionary transitions happening.
Well, you're a geologist, and this brings us to your geological expertise. As I understand it, you know, these fossils are buried in old dirt and old mud and so forth that becomes rock. If there were evidence that they're talking about, how could there be a gap? I mean, how could you have a lot of fossils, then nothing, and then different fossils if it's all connected?
So if you talk about the hominid fossil record, it's sparse largely throughout the whole thing. Many biologists have complained about the fact that there are very, very few hominid fossils to even go on. In fact, Jerry Coyne, who's a well-known evolutionary biologist, this is just going off memory, so this is sort of probably going to be a paraphrase rather than an exact quote, but he has this pithy quote where he says, paleoanthropology is a remarkable subject and that there are more practitioners of the field than there are data points to study. Okay. So I think that's interesting. There's really not a lot of data to go on, and they construct these grand evolutionary narratives. So when we say there's a gap, what we're saying is, you know, they claim that human beings, that our genus Homo evolved from an ape-like genus called Australopithecus. But then when you ask them, are there fossils that actually document that evolution? They will say no. So, or if they're being honest, they will say no. So in that sense, there is a gap for their model. The data does not support their model. That's the way I would put it.
With regard to animal evolution, can they show, for example, with whales, that whales' ancestors lived on the land and then ended up in the sea? Is there a consistent fossil record that demonstrates that?
Well, you will certainly hear in that case that a lot of evolutionary biologists will say that there are fossils demonstrating how land mammals evolved into fully aquatic whales. The way that the basic evolutionary story goes is they will say that, you know, probably 380 million years ago, amphibians crawled out of the sea, started walking on land. Those amphibians evolved into reptiles. Some of those reptiles evolved into mammals. Some of those mammals who were walking on land then evolved the ability to go back into the sea. And this was around maybe 45 to 50 million years ago. They evolved back into this aquatic form that we now know as whales. Okay. So it is claimed that there are some fossils documenting that evolutionary transition. I've looked at this. I'm not saying that they don't have any evidence. I think they have some evidence. I don't think that the fossils are quite as compelling as it is claimed. However, for me, this is the big question. We can ask the question, are there fossils that seem to have intermediate body plans, intermediate morphology? And the answer could be yes. But, and I remember learning about this when I was in my undergraduate and master's studies, Wesley, the timeline of land mammals, fully terrestrial land mammals, evolving into fully aquatic whales is so short that it's very difficult to imagine how that normal evolutionary mechanisms, you know, random mutation, natural selection, how they could cause all those changes to occur going from a land mammal to a whale in literally just a few million years. Okay. That is not enough time. When, if you're talking about a group of organisms like whales, the evolutionary process is sort of working against them. They tend to have small population sizes, long generation times, and low mutation rates. That is sort of the worst case scenario for being able to evolve new traits. And so whatever happened with whales, if there was some evolutionary process and these fossils might document that, it was not standard blind evolutionary mechanisms. I think that the math is very clear. When you do the population genetics math, there's simply too many changes that have to take place to go from a land mammal to a whale, and not enough time for standard evolutionary mechanisms or any evolutionary mechanisms that we are aware of to be able to accomplish those changes.
You're talking natural selection.
Natural selection, random mutation, genetic drift, all those things. Yeah. There's not enough time.
That's interesting, which is, of course, another issue in the ID world that we're not going to get into. But I think the point I meant to bring up is that, at least with whales, you do have some fossil record that might support the argument that is being made that they went back to the sea. And you're saying that with regard to humans, that fossil record does not exist.
Yeah, what you just said is very fair. It is possible for fossils to support an evolutionary claim. And I think with whales, it's one of their best examples. In fact, the evolution of whales has been called the, quote, poster child for macroevolution, because it's one of the few examples where they actually think they do have fossils showing these intermediate forms. But in the case of the origin of the human-like body plan, I would argue those fossils are by and large lacking.
So what do you think is the larger message here in terms of this issue, the connection, whether it exists or not, between humans and chimps? Is it important? And if so, why is it important?
Well, I think for me, the larger message is to be very careful when you hear mainstream promoters of science and especially evolutionary biology claiming that we know this for an absolute fact. I mean, I can't tell you how many people over the years told us, for a fact, that we were only 1 to 2% genetically different from chimps. And this came not just from, you know, popularizers like Bill Nye, the Science Guy, but also from University of Chicago press books, articles in the journal Science, articles in the mainstream media. From the top to the bottom, people were making this claim. So I think we need to, as members of the public, be willing to have a healthy skepticism and to remember these examples. So when somebody tells you, you don't have the right to question what quote unquote science says, S-E-Z, you know, science with a capital S, you're not allowed to question this. Remind them of these examples where science turned out to be wrong, or at least science changed after it had been promoting an idea so forcefully. We have to remember these things so that people have the ability and they can reserve space for themselves to actually ask hard questions. Because if we can't do that, then science can never progress. So for me, that really is the moral of this story.
I think that's very good, because if you stifle the ability to challenge orthodoxies, science becomes sclerotic and you miss the dynamism that is at the heart and soul of the scientific method.
100%, Wesley. If you cannot challenge even the consensus, then science can never progress. Every single new scientific theory, every single scientific revolution started off as a minority scientific view that was challenging the consensus. And if we can't do that, then science is going to get stuck. And I think a lot of people would argue that today science is becoming more and more politicized, and that's not good for the practice of science, and it doesn't bode well for the future.
Well, Casey, this has been very interesting, and I wanted to work on this chimp, 1% chimp, 15% chimp. It doesn't mean that we're part chimp or that they're part human, because in the end, all biological life is built of the same physical material, right?
We all use DNA. We all use proteins. We're using it in different ways, and that's okay. It's, in fact, if we didn't all use the same basic biomolecules, Wesley, then when you eat a fish or you eat grain in your Cheerios in the morning, it wouldn't be nutritious to you. It's because we all use the same basic biomolecules that we can be part of the same ecosphere and we can survive. So it has to be this way.
So that means we're also part earthworm, and earthworms are part us.
Well, if you eat earthworms, then yeah, I suppose so. Yeah.
Well, we're out of time. What next for Casey Luskin?
Well, first I'm going to try to get over this cold I have, but I've got a lot of speaking coming up. I'm speaking at, I think, 4 or 5 universities over the next few weeks. So I got to prepare a lot of presentations and get ready to go on the road, get better so I can go on the road here.
Well, good. And thanks for being on Humanize, and we'll talk to you again.
Thanks so much, Wesley. A lot of fun.
Thanks for listening to Humanize from Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism, where human rights meet human responsibilities. Discover all the good work of the Center on Human Exceptionalism by visiting discovery.org/human. We can only do this work, speaking on behalf of human life, human thriving, and our exceptional place in this world and our cosmos, with your support. We invite you to make a one-time gift today and to consider starting a monthly gift to support the Center on Human Exceptionalism and this show. Wherever you're listening to Humanize, please take a moment to rate and review the show. You matter. Your actions matter. Be bold, be exceptional, and be back soon.